Welcome to JVL, your place to learn from Japan's venture leaders about the promising startup ecosystem in the land of the rising sun. Hey everybody, I'm Kento, your host for JVL, and today I'm talking to Alex Urajima. Alex is a well-known personality in Japan's venture space, where he has been helping create multiple startups and connecting startup ecosystems around the globe. His network spans many different stakeholders, such as government, founders, investors, and many more. And due to his 15-year experience seeing the evolution of the ecosystem, I was curious to learn from his personal stories and experience up close. So thanks for listening in, and please enjoy my conversation with Alex. All right, Alex, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast today. I'm very happy to have you. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I'm doing very fine. And you?
Nice. I'm also very excited to talk to you. I mean, we've already talked a couple of times in real life, and just hearing from like all the different things that you're involved with in terms of the startup ecosystem made me thought that you might know a lot and you can contribute a lot to me and the listeners understanding more about the current state of the startup ecosystem. So thanks a lot for taking the time. I know you're very busy, involved in a lot of things, but I'm very interested to hear about some of these stories you can share. To get started, I would just like to first hear about what is your connection to Japan and what are like the things that you're currently spending most time on professionally.
Okay. So my name is Alex Odajima. So I'm a French and Japanese mixed. I'm born and raised in Tokyo. I just spent 4 years in Paris for my university, but otherwise I've always been in Tokyo. And then I'm involved in the startup here for about 15 years now. So the whole thing has started when the iPhone came to Japan, so 2008. And I got involved in many project management of entertainment, web services, game companies, iPhone app companies, etc. And I was really lucky to be involved with SoftBank project when the iPhone came to Japan. And that's how I got involved in some of the bringing foreign startups to Japan-ish projects. But very, very low level involvement, like the doing marketing research, trying to figure out how the value proposition could be adjusted for the Japanese market, trying to make suggestions, etc. And then I've been working in many different projects as a project manager, or I've been doing customer support and many different things here and there. And for the last few years, I'm really focusing on helping foreign startups come to the Japanese market and vice versa. So the inbound and outbound of startups. But that doesn't make much money. So I'm doing consulting service for big Japanese corporations on open innovation, startup related project. So that's the two big things I'm involved currently.
Okay, makes sense. And it seems like you had a very gradual transition into the startup world. And now you have, it seems like this big mission of trying to connect different startup ecosystems with each other now that you're like a little bit more established and have more knowledge and probably also a bigger network. What motivates you to be in the role of connector? Is your mission to empower founders in Japan, or what is really the underlying thing that connects the different things you do in the startup ecosystem?
So I'd say it's more like the many multitude of combination of different coincidences made me do what I'm doing right now. And also because of my background of being in a multicultural family, you know, it was natural for me to be in between different countries and different cultures. So I feel like I was very lucky to be someone who has this quite unique capability of understanding different cultures, being able to be the bridge between Japan and other countries, or between startups and big corporate, or between government and innovators, etc. So that's why I very much like what I do. So that's probably the biggest reason why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I like it and I'm enjoying it. The reason why I'm staying in Japan is a bit difficult, but it's more like because it's cheap, you know. Right now, when you compare it to other countries, it's way cheaper. Compared to the quality of what we can afford here. And Also, having a son, 8 years old, I can't afford to live in the States. It's too expensive. Where if you want to bring your son to hospital, or those kind of things, it makes me Tokyo the best option that I can think of for now. And I also feel very much, it's not like an obligation, but I feel like I have almost like a mission to help out the very domestic Japanese startup ecosystem to go more to global. Like, it's difficult to find the word in English, but it's very mottainai. It's very, I feel, I don't know how to say it. It's a waste of talent, waste of technology, waste of opportunity for many of very, very talented Japanese entrepreneurs, engineers, who don't really think about what's going on outside of the borders, and very closed within this Japan country and the Japanese language, right? So I feel like it's very important to open the gate and try to create more interaction. And unfortunately, it's much easier to bring in people here than encouraging people to go outside. But I think when we'll have more foreign startups coming here, and Japanese people getting involved with foreign startups at early phase of their life, I think it's going to change the mindset, and we will see more and more Japanese entrepreneurs and startups thinking global from day one and wishing to go outside. So that's kind of my motivation.
Yeah, I think this open mindset question is something that I've talked with a lot of people about. And yeah, I think my view has always been like changing. And like I start up with one view, and then by talking to one person, it completely changes again. This on the topic of like open mindset, maybe like very general question. My belief is that maybe there is a little bit of an closed-mindedness, is a little bit of an intrinsic characteristic of the mindset in Japan. And maybe it's not meant to be changed. Like it's maybe just a hypothesis, but maybe it's just like a Western belief that open-mindedness is a good thing, and maybe it's something unique to Japan that is not to be played around with. As a thought experiment, like how do you think about that? Like, is there anything good about having this close-mindedness?
Well, I think it's very much about the circumstances or the environment. Like, for example, you're born, I'm 42, I'm born 1980. So I grew up in the phase of all the anime and all those, Japanese content becoming slowly global, like Nintendo, etc., right? But the peak of the content pop culture in Japan was when I was a teenager. So Japan was by far the number one gaming country, and we are still almost the best country in terms of anime and manga, right? And so as a young kid, I didn't need to learn any other languages to enjoy the best content. So speaking Japanese was enough to play the best games, read the best manga, and see the best anime, right? But when you go to European countries, like Greece or Finland, where you don't have much population, they must learn English or other language to get access to other content. So there is, from the very early age, there is this wish to learn English, get access to what they would like to see, to watch, etc. So I think there's, people may laugh when I said it's all for manga, but the number of people I've met in my life who were trying to study Japanese was because they wanted to read manga in the original language. Right? So this motivation at younger age, I think it has a significant impact, first of all. And when you live in Japan, it is changing very fast, but still, it was really rare to meet people who were not able to speak Japanese. And myself being French and Japanese mixed, anyone who would see my picture would never think I am Japanese because I don't look Japanese. And I have a Japanese passport. I fluently speak Japanese, but from the moment they see me, suddenly I'm not Japanese anymore. I'm a foreigner. So being Japanese is not only about the passport or how you think mentally, it's how you look like. And that's changing, but still, until early 2000, you was a very ethnic, closed environment here. So it was very isolated from rest of the world, because no, very few people were actually living in Japan, and even some people who were living here, like Korean, Chinese origin people, they speak Japanese too well that you wouldn't recognize until you really become close and you one day discover that they actually were not Japanese, right? And so really the environment is so isolated. And when you live in Japan, you grow up in Japan, you have enough content, you can learn enough things in Japanese, and the economy is big enough to survive. It's still the third biggest country. It was the second biggest country when I was younger. So, when you're born in Japan as a Japanese person, you don't need to think about what's going on outside. And this is the environment where Japanese people grew up, and it's drastically changing the last few years, and even more this year. But still, the most of people who are at the working age, they never really had to interact with the outside. They never really thought about it because it was not necessary. It was not something which would happen naturally. Right, so that probably the biggest reason why Japanese people are very domestic and they never try to go abroad, because they don't feel the necessity of it.
Yeah. And since we're still in the phase of like learning more about you as a person, like one thing that I also sometimes like grapple with is the idea of what's your identity. And since you as a half French, half Japanese person with like a lot of abroad experience now living in Japan, have also probably some responsibility in assimilating to how things work in Japan and basically adapting to some aspects of everyday life. How do you think about being true to yourself, while still trying to assimilate, like this identity, positioning on the spectrum of Japanese and maybe Western mindset? Like, how do you think about how you can adjust that positioning?
Well, I'd say I was really lucky to never had an identity crisis. I never
Okay, that's cool.
was nothing very serious to me. I know some friends that I was with. I was at, so to begin with, I was at the French school here in Tokyo. I went to elementary school till the age of 11 to a Japanese public school, and then I switched to a French school in Tokyo where we had more than 30 different nationalities, and extremely diverse environment where, being from a certain country was not meaning anything there. So we and also like because I have French and Japan's mixed culture, I never thought I was Japanese or French. I never really care about nationality, right? The symbol on my passport was just like a utility thing, I never really considered myself being Japanese or being French. I'm from Earth, I so
Same, same.
right. So I think that's for most of the mixed people who grew up in good environment probably think the same way. On the other hand, I had few friends who kind of refusing their French part of their identity, trying to really merge in this very domestic Japanese culture, trying to hide their, foreign origin. That's, I personally think it's sad, but it's a choice, So for me, I never have been considered as a Japanese person either, because on the street, like I remember when I was a kid, I want probably was something like 10 years old. I once I got lost, and I tried to ask the way to someone there, and I approached them with a perfectly fluent Japanese. Hey, excuse me. The person ran away, saying I don't speak English, and they run away.
Oh, okay. I
because
mean, it's
of
funny, but it's also sad.
yeah, right. But I got used to that kind of incidents from a very early age. I got used to it, and I'd say, well, that's how people would react. And I can understand the Japanese people being afraid of having conversation with foreigners. So, you know, never been an issue for me. I never really cared about it. You
know. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. That's probably one way to deal with avoiding an identity crisis, right? Just not think about it. Nice. All right. So now you already teasered the startup topic a little bit by saying that, oh, you think it's a little bit a wasted opportunity for Japanese founders or engineers to just have a mindset limited to Japan. But maybe taking one step higher, like a bird eye perspective on how you felt like the startup ecosystem has changed or evolved over the last, I don't know, decade, or you said you have been here like for 15 years in the startup ecosystem, right? So what changes have you noticed? What was obvious? What was unpredicted? Yeah, what was your feeling?
So when I started, the word startup didn't exist yet. So we were calling these kind of companies venture companies, venture. And still the idea of investment was virtually inexistent, right? So the amount of investment to those early phase companies were so small that, you know, it was the entrepreneur who had to take personal risk to make loans to pay for the adventure. And in Japan, if you fail, it's kind of game over. It's extremely difficult to come back, right? And so it's extremely high risk to it was super high risk to start a company. And I think evolved very much. I think last year we had about $8 billion of investment to startups. So it's still kind of about 5% of the amount happening in the US, but still it's growing very, very fast. Because about 3 years ago, the amount it was almost half, right? So it's increasing very, very fast. So the money going to startups is growing extremely fast. So, which means that people can take risk a bit easier than it used to be. So we are having more challengers, you know, so that's a very good thing. Another thing is that the myth of being hired in a big company would assure a successful life. You know, that was a myth, which is unfortunately disappearing right now. And all big companies are struggling, a lot of layoffs. So young generation are starting to realize that, okay, going to big companies or big banks wouldn't promise a wonderful life anymore. So there is a much bigger incentive to join a startup from day one in Japan too. So, and then the government, because the corporate are keeping too much cash in their bank account, right? So there's about almost $4.5 trillion in the bank account owned by big corporates. Stay there because they don't risk to make investments. The ratio of R&D investments of big corporates compared to the profit decreasing in Japan. So when you do take this ratio in the States, the profit grows, but the ratio of amount going to R&D is also growing. Not only the amount itself, but the ratio is growing. But in Japan, not only the amount is decreasing, but the ratio is decreasing, which means that when you compare the investment to innovation between countries, the situation is quite critical. So big corporates are literally keeping cash to prepare just in case something would happen, like the COVID or like the Lehman shock or, you know, those kind of thing. And the salary is not growing. The annual wage of average people, I think the average wage has decreased of about 1% in 20 years, when in most of countries it increased for almost 20%. So literally the big corporates are not investing for the future at all. And so the government is trying to create different rules to push them to invest. And because they spend too much years not innovating themselves. What they do is to create CVCs, corporate VC, invest to startups. It's almost like they're outsourcing innovation. And so that's a big trend. We call this the open innovation in Japan. It's a way to for the corporate to spend a bit of money to startups to show that they're trying to be innovative, right? So almost probably less than 10% of those CVCs are not a real innovators. All the rest is just like trying to show that they're trying to do something not then actually doing something. But still, we are having more and more examples of investment coming from corporates who are facilitating the growth of startups. So those things, so the change of mindset of young people, the government trying to create regulations to push companies to make investments, and the end of big corporate myth. Those things combined are probably the reason why the startup ecosystem is growing much more than used to be 15 years old.
And one thing that I'm frequently seeing, I feel like there's always this comparison to the US, right? Like, in the US, they have that many companies or unicorns in relation to that much GDP, and Japan's GDP is that high. As a result, Japan is supposed to have that many unicorns. Do you think that's a fair comparison to expect Japan to have like the same relative amount of unicorns than in the US or in the West, or is there maybe, I don't know?
There are different things we have to be careful about. First, the term unicorns apply to companies who are not before IPO, right? A listed company cannot be considered an unicorn by definition. The problem is in Japan, there are three kind of stock exchange market, and the level three, the lowest one, has been designed specially for early stage company to raise funds for the growth phase. So it used to be called the mothers. Now is, I don't know the exact term in English, but it's the Tokyo Exchange Market Class 3 or something. So they changed the labelization of it. But the characteristic is that it's a very, very easy market to go IPO. And so we have startups in Japan who would go IPO for just like 50, 100 million US dollars. You know, something in the States that would be almost Series B, C, right? So from the moment they go IPO in Japan at this small exchange market, and they can't be an unicorn anymore because they did an IPO. But there are many companies, when you look at their valuation or the amount they've raised at this public market, in the state, it would be considered as still a startup pre-IPO. So if you include those smaller companies who are technically is a listed company, but actually are still a startup, I think the number of unicorns in Japan would triple. Right. I don't have the exact numbers, but we at least have 30, 35 unicorn level size of companies in Japan, but are not considered as an unicorn because they're a listed company. Right. So there's this tricky part. And on the other side, there's so many different things which is different from the States. For example, in Japan, you are a CEO of a company, right? And when you make a loan to banks, you have to become personal responsible. So even if you shut down the company, the debt will follow you for the rest of your life. Yeah. So if you only use investment, then you don't need to pay back, right? You don't have a debt. But from the moment, even $1 million loan from the bank, and if you know that it's going to follow you the rest of your life, even if you shut down the company, it's very, very high risk to take. And so that's why Japanese companies tend to play safe, because the incentive for the CEOs, the high risk, high return is too high risk. because if you fail once, it's extremely difficult to come back.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So
Like, yeah.
It's independent from any company firm you form in Japan. Like
Yeah.
any company firm you do, as soon as you raise debt capital, then it's
Yeah,
connected to
it's
you
almost
personally.
like automatically a bank would ask the CEO to become a personal guarantor, no, hoshonin of the loan. Right? So that's why it's very super risky for a person to. And like I always use the example of Donald Trump. He got bankrupt, I think, three or four times, right? And that's something which probably would never happen in Japan. If you go bankrupt once, then you will never be able to come back, or it's extremely difficult. And bank won't allow to loan money anymore, So I think the high risk, high return is a very difficult model to opt in Japan. For social design, like social infrastructure design, as I described, but culturally speaking, Japanese people don't like risk takers. Because, historically speaking, Japanese society was always about sharing responsibility, being mutually responsible about the growth of the village, So someone taking high risk would put in jeopardy everyone. So if someone would take high risk, say, hey, stop. Don't try to do anything stupid. Just play safe as everybody else, right? And if the person succeed, people would be jealous and say, oh yeah, he cheated, And that's why most of entrepreneurs here, like Elon Musk kind of person, won't become a hero here. People would say bad thing about the person and say, yeah, he cheated, or he's not, walking like doing enough effort. Struggling is a good thing here. So the culturally speaking, it's very difficult to do take a risk and try to do something new because people are not taking this as a good thing. So I think the combination of the two make very difficult for in Japan to stand out as an entrepreneur.
So since the like taking on debt capital is like too risky, it becomes even more important to have alternative ways of financing like equity, right? Like NVC and CVC. And what I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned that a person like Elon Musk could not succeed in Japan, but I imagine that there are probably like, even if there are just few like startup role models, people who made it in the startup sense, who are maybe like very wealthy nowadays, but also created huge societal value through their startups. Like from your perspective, having lived in Japan in the startup ecosystem, who would you think is thought of from the general public as very good founders, like people who've made it but still are respected by most?
Okay. Maybe, sorry, I might have been a bit confusing. So I'm not saying that it's difficult to succeed as an entrepreneur, but the thing is, successful entrepreneurs might not be considered as a hero, like he or she would be in the States or in China. I don't know. So like as a good example would be Horie-san. Like he got even arrested, or Maezono-san from ZOZOTOWN.
Yeah,
Saying so many
they're not
people,
that liked, right?
yeah, right. So, yeah, it's not. Or it's Son-san, Son Masayoshi, the CEO of SoftBank. He's also a very successful entrepreneur. All those people were socially successful, but so many people are against them. Are like, yeah, they are not doing good thing, or they are not doing thing in the right way. There is an expression in Japanese, so how would it say, to walking and sweating.
Okay.
So it's more like the idea is that walking means is doing a lot of effort, is a lot of suffering, and endure all those difficulties. So people who would do stock trick or, you know, would go shortcut to make profit without spending much time, I feel like in the States, they would be considered as super smart. And they did the good thing, the right thing. So let's try to do like them. That would be more the mentality in the States. But in Japan, they will be considered, okay, he's a cheater. You know, his money is not a good money. You know, it's a dirty money if you are not sweating, right? So it's still a very deep mindset, mentality in Japanese people. And spending a lot of time, even meaninglessly, you know, would be more valuable than
for public perception.
Yeah. So like in small companies, for example, if you, let's say you work in the accounts division and you know a bit about Excel macro, and you create some macro to shortcut a lot of tasks you were working, right? And you make 2 hours less work time per day, that will be like, okay, this guy is cheating. So, and that's unfortunately still true in many companies. So people tend to spend time, well, like I know that a lot of people are creating those macro, but they're not saying it to the supervisor, and would spend the 2 hours, you know, on the web, doing Facebook. So efficiency is against the core value of Japanese culture. That's another big issue, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, I never really thought deeply about it, but I always thought like, oh, Japan, that's the country that's supposed to be efficient. But maybe that's just an illusion. Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, crazy. I mean, so like talking to a lot of people, whenever I say like, oh, I'm from Germany, but I also am Japanese, then people say like, oh yeah, these countries have the similarity of being very efficient, right? But this is the first time I'm actually hearing about it actually not being maybe 100% true. And on the topic of founders, that are how they're perceived publicly, you just mentioned like some examples of people who are who don't publicly sweat a lot, but for some reason, through maybe some I don't know, smart thinking, were able to get to the top. What are examples of founders who are very well perceived, who've done well financially maybe, but are still thought of by the general public as people
the entrepreneurs. Yeah. Of the early entrepreneurs after the war, so like Matsushita, which Panasonic now, so, you know, the founder of Panasonic, he's considered kind of god of management, right? And Honda, same, and the founders of Sony, those people are considered as a god of management, entrepreneurship. But when you look at the episodes of those people, which are considered as being a good thing, is like they spend a lot of time doing something and they did a lot of effort. You know, that's like someone who do difficult thing, they should be rewarded. So that's for sure true in Japan. But being smart to avoid those effort, it's somehow something else, you know. So the let's take the example outside of Japan so that everyone could think about it. Edison, for example, Thomas Edison. You know, he spent his childhood trying to do a lot of experiments, and you know, he spent a lot of time inventing things. I'm not saying that he was a fair businessman. I know about those things, but in Japan, because he did a lot of effort when he was young, so people can take his remuneration more easily. And you know, also the kind of effort they were doing was easier to understand, right? Doing hundreds and thousands of experiments, failing and being tenacious and continuing is easy to understand. Where it comes to someone who would find a super ingenious trick on stock market, or you know, say, oh, that could be a very great idea and create a startup within a few years and become a billionaire in 5 years. That is not enough sacrifice or not enough sweating to be considered as a hero. So that will be the cases. Like famous entrepreneurs considered as a hero in Japan are those old school ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe there is an overlap there because maybe it's just an assumption, but it feels like the kind of people who who are very happy and are like big fans of these old school founders maybe also tend to be rather the older generation in Japan. And maybe like their value system is tied around like, oh, do they just at least seem to be working hard and that's something you value, versus maybe like the younger generation whose voice is maybe not that strong in Japan yet, like maybe they think a little bit differently. So probably also at some point be interesting to hear like how the how different generations think about who is cool or who is like has been a good founder in Japan. I'm sure there are some interesting differences there.
Sure. Yeah, and yeah. Like not going till the founder level, but at the daily management level, until the COVID in Japan, the most important part is to show your manager that you were suffering, like you were trying something difficult. So many people were staying at the company without doing anything, but just for the sake to show that they were doing a lot of effort, they were staying there. But the COVID has drastically changed the situation. Now the company were forced to value the output of the employees, right? And not the time they would spend on it. And suddenly the managers, the old style managers, were in a very difficult situation because they were not able to design the necessary output per employee or, you know, and they that's why a lot of Japanese companies are wishing the employees to come back to the office, to go back to before, where being at the office was enough, like almost like that was the value proposition of an employee. And so that's, I think, still a core issue of a Japanese society or corporate design. Like employees are considered as a member, could do whatever the company would need at any time, right? So being available anytime was very important. So it's changing very fast and drastically, but still, at least for the people of 40, 50 years old, we all knew the period of we should be available all day, all night, right? And be capable of answering the company's need at any time. If the company would ask you to move to Hokkaido or Okinawa from the north to south, that you should be able to do it. And those are the ones who are loyal, who would grow higher in the hierarchy. That's the mindset of the Showa, the 80s, 90s. But younger generation, first of all, they don't have this hope of staying in the same company and be automatically increased in salary, etc. So they know that they can't count on companies to do that. So they don't have this loyalty. The work-life balance is much more important. And so there is a huge gap, especially those who started to work during the COVID. It has an even bigger gap. But I think we will have serious social symptoms surfacing within 2-3 years, where those people would become much bigger in terms of numbers.
Okay, well, to just quickly summarize like the startup ecosystem view from your perspective, at the beginning you basically painted this picture of a lot has happened over the last decades, and now is more opportunity than ever in the context of maybe more government attention to the area of startups, but also just like more capital available and maybe people who are like fed up with this lifetime employment concept and maybe are now over the next 2 or 3 years, considering other ways of how they can think about employment or maybe also meaning of life, if you think about it bigger. And the second part, you talked a little bit more about how it is kind of a delicate dance to think about how maybe you build yourself as a personality, or maybe you're not a person who cares about public perception anyways, and then that's maybe not something you need to care about. But maybe like any person or any entity that does rely at some to some degree on public perception probably needs to play this very delicate act of thinking about what to show, what not to show, because that seems to be a big thing in terms of what people in Japan value. Moving on to the last section, which is a topic you proposed, I came up with a topic of you talking to a lot of different maybe startup enthusiasts or even founders who tell you about their wish that they want to become rich by being a founder. Can you tell me a little bit more about like what kind of conversations you had and why you think that's an issue?
Yeah, so I had a lot of requests doing seminars for students in entrepreneurship, etc. And most of the time, the first thing I told them is to not becoming an entrepreneur is the best way if you just want to become rich. Because when you consider the ROI, the time you spend, the possibility to becoming a rich person, I think becoming an entrepreneur is definitely not the best option. So if you spend the same amount of effort trying to join companies such as the Goldman Sachs or, you know, those kind of money-making companies, it's much easier if you're just about becoming rich. I think it's better to go in that direction as an option. And so that's one thing. And the reason why is that for me, being an entrepreneur is not a goal. It's just a choice you make because to achieve something you really want to do, right? There is another goal, and there is just, it's a way to solve this issue. You didn't have any other option than becoming entrepreneur yourself, right? And an entrepreneur is just the nature of someone who is trying to do something. This person is actually an entrepreneur, but it's not the goal, right? And I meet so many young students who say, yeah, I want to become an entrepreneur, but I don't know what I do. I was like, okay, that's not, the order is wrong. First, find something you want to do, and trying to find someone who's already doing it and join the team, which is the best way to achieve your goal. And really, at the end, you really can't find anyone else doing the thing you are doing, and you can't think of anything else. Then, yeah, maybe you don't have any other choice than create the company yourself. But that's really the last option for me.
What's usually the reaction you get from students when you tell them, hey, don't do it for the money?
They're like, yeah, well, some are, you know, there's so many irresponsible adults who would push the young kids, say, yeah, you should start your company, or yeah, it's great to become an entrepreneur, right?
Interesting. Okay.
But, you know, they won't take the responsibility of the failure, right? And especially in Japan, let's say you're a student, you're graduating. If you try to create your company without joining a company, then it's almost impossible to come back to the normal path of being hired in a company, have a stable income, and have enough time on the weekend to do something else. You know, so it's really a super high risk. So unless you have already some idea that you were obsessed about, and you can't think of anything else, that's high risk for nothing. So, and it's never too late. The average age of entrepreneurs, successful entrepreneurs, it's probably 30, 40 years old when they started their new businesses, right? I think the same applies for Jeff Bezos. He was almost same age as I was, you know, I am, when he started Amazon. So it's never too late. And joining a company, creating your business network is always useful. having minimum amount of experience in corporate to understand how company works and the purchase order and those kind of basics of real life, you can't learn it at MBA, where especially you never can learn anything at Japanese universities anyway. So, and joining a big company will assure you a minimum income, enough time to think about business plans on the weekends. So really, I very strongly suggest young students to join a company first. It's never too late. And if you're really enthusiast and if you're serious about creating your own company, you will find a way to go there. But if you're just dreaming of becoming an entrepreneur without knowing what you want to do, that's like, I want to become a musician. It's exactly the same thing. I never touch a guitar in my life, but I want to become a musician and become a billionaire. Like, come on, right? So that's the sad truth. And especially in Japan, so many students are like, yeah, I want to become a rock star. Kind of. And I asked about, okay, so what's your business plan? It's not even a plan. It's just like, I want to create a special kind of crypto coin. And so what's the idea? So no, I want to create a crypto coin and that's it. You know, so okay. So yeah, that's not a business plan at all. So, you know.
Do you think these young students are inspired by entrepreneurs in the US, or do you think they have their role models in Japan, or?
Well, I think it's two things. One is that they're probably inspired by Japanese and foreign entrepreneurs. The other thing is they lost so much hope in the used to be the good path of joining big company that they have to think about other options and they are desperate. And they say, yeah, well, okay, joining a big company is apparently not the best thing to do now. So maybe I should think about creating my own company, you know. So I'm not blaming them, but they are very unfortunate situation. But still, starting a company is an extremely serious decision of your life. So first, you have to find the idea you're obsessed about and you want to realize it no matter what. And then creating a company is just a tool. So yeah, first you have to find this passion.
So that's the trend of people wanting to found because they want to become rich. Is that something you observe only among the young students?
I won't say that it's because they want to become rich only. They're more about not the money, but more the the idea, the status or the, you know, and a lot are serious about social issues. So they think, yeah, I want to solve this social issue. And so that's why I want to become a social impact entrepreneur. You know, it's, I'd say maybe less than half are thinking about it for the money, but more about they want to do something unique. You know, they want to differentiate from the others.
I think in that sense, that's not inherently a bad thing. I think like up until now, people were basically, they didn't have to think about what they do next. Like it was just basically a routine that everyone goes through and everyone is the same and everything stays the same and nothing changes. And just the ability for people to start thinking and considering what are their options and maybe trying out things that might fail. But in that regard, like, just being able to have acted on your own belief and conviction is maybe also something that is like respectable. Like that's not something normal, I think. That takes a lot of courage. And in that sense, like maybe you need to tweak your motivations a little bit, but just basically acting on behalf of conviction is something that I think is needed more of. And it's good to hear at least that there are more and more of these people who think that way. You were talking a lot about hearing these stories from students. Is that also something you observe from founders who maybe have worked a couple of years? Like, do they have similar motivations or do their motivations change a little bit?
Well, I think in general, not only for people joining, becoming entrepreneur or joining startups, I think the majority of young Japanese people are super serious about social goals. Like, not, I'm not talking about the UN SDGs, but literally trying to find a way to how to contribute to the society. It's becoming, so we call this the purpose of the company. A lot of companies are announcing the purpose, and I've heard that more than 80% of students are selecting the company based on the purposes.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
So it's becoming a very, very important topic. And so I think there is this change of mindset among young generation that, yeah, having a meaningful professional career, not for the money, but in terms of social contribution, is now much, much more important than it used to be 10 years ago.
Okay. I mean, I guess that's a nice wrap-up statement. I think we talked a little bit about like how things may be lacking in Japan, but I think this optimism still persists, and the young generation is the next generation of promising not just founders, but thinkers and people who have the power in the next generations to maybe make society a better place in Japan. So yeah, that's very encouraging to hear. To wrap up our session, I wanted to try out a new format, which is like three rapid fire questions that I just expect short answers from you on. And maybe just like one word answers would also suffice. So the first question would be, what does Japan need to blossom?
Allowing people to make mistakes.
Okay. Then, and it's random questions. Don't get like too confused about like the randomness. Okay. What is your favorite place in Japan?
I don't know. Shibuya kana? Shibuya? Yeah.
Okay, nice. Yeah. Last question. What makes you happy?
When I manage to find a solution for complicated problems.
Okay. And hopefully you don't solve them like too efficiently, otherwise people get upset, right? All right. Nice. Alex, thanks a lot for your time. It was very interesting. Like we diverged sometimes from my script, but I think it was like very interesting in terms of the stories you shared, and I learned a lot also. So yeah, thanks a lot, and excited to talk to you next time.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of JVL. I really enjoyed this conversation with Alex because he shared his insights not just on the startup ecosystem, but also shed some light on the Japanese mindset in general. Hearing from the many positive developments that are affecting startups in Japan strengthened my optimism for what's to come. And it was also nice to know that more and more of the young generation here think about how to tackle social challenges through their actions and critical thinking. If you liked this episode, please follow and rate it on whichever podcast platform you're listening from. And for feedback, please reach out to jvl.podcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, and see you next time.